Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Sports competitions are very intense moments when professional athletes must perform at their best. And sometimes they get injured. Experts say being an athlete entails some risk of injuries, whether one is a professional athlete or not. Today we will discuss some basics about sports and exercise and look at some ways to prevent injuries, as well as some tips to stay fit. And to do that, joining us via phone from Brambleton, Virginia, is Riz Gully, our guest of today. Riz is site director with Brambleton One Life Fitness. Riz Gully, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So let's get right into it. Let's talk about sports. I mean, we hear all the time that sports is good for your health. Sports is good to stay healthy, to stay in shape, to lose weight, and all of the good stuff that we hear every day. So talk to us about how sports can help adults as well as kids to be in good health.
Yeah, I mean, sports are great. I mean, even if you're a young kid, even if you're an adult, I think it's something that everyone should participate in, because there's many things you get besides the physical benefits of sports. I mean, you get the accountability or the dependability of others encouraging you to come and play. Also, while you're there, they're motivating you, giving you confidence. So it's a way where you can sort of exercise but not really think you're exercising because you're having such a good time with people. So if that's something you can start as a habit as a young kid at the earliest age of like 2 or 3, awesome. And if you can keep that going and going, you're going to learn a lot of traits, especially when it comes into the business world, working with others as a team, that you wouldn't get if you didn't play sports. And then the positive of all that, of course, is your health is going to be great and you're going to have fun while doing it.
So you said to start at 2 or 3 if possible. Isn't it too young to start exercising?
No, I mean, it's all about checks and balances if you think about it. Like, everyone says, oh, drinking is bad, okay? Well, if you have one beer a day or one wine a day, it's actually pretty healthy for you to do that. So I look at fitness the same way. We just got to know what's appropriate for you. So if you're 2 or 3 and you're playing downstairs in the basement, you might have a little Fisher-Price basketball hoop. You might have some Legos.
Yes.
You might have some balls that you kick around. That's a sport. You may just be by yourself.
Okay.
So I know my son, he's about to turn 3 in September. He's been playing soccer for a year already. So that cardiovascular of him just running around, him kicking a soccer ball is also helping with his hand-eye coordination. It's just helping with him coming into his young kid age. But also, as he goes through all that, he's developing all these other traits that are going to help him with any type of physical fitness he may do or health overall.
That's a good point, because when we hear exercising, usually, some people think of exercising as something like very difficult to do, something like a daunting task that you have to do because you don't have a choice. That's what you have to do to be healthy. But it depends on how we can approach it to make it fun, right? So what kind of tips would you give adults to make exercise fun so that it doesn't become such a burden? For those of us, we think of it as a burden.
Yeah, I mean, some adults do think it that way. It's a burden, or they might be too scared to enter a gym, right? Because they might be ashamed of how they look or even how they feel. Like, oh, man, if I do 10 minutes on the treadmill, I'm dead. Everyone else around me is, like, still going.
That's how I feel.
They might lack the confidence or be embarrassed to even step into a gym. So, I mean, ways we can overcome that is grab a friend, someone that's going to encourage you, someone that you may not be so self-conscious because you're around them and you two are doing the same thing. They can hold you accountable. Like we were talking about earlier, go play sports. It doesn't have to be in a gym setting. You can go play kickball. I know here in D.C. there's a bunch of Thursday night kickball leagues you can do. A couple of my clients do some softball leagues, some men's basketball leagues, or then you got your weekend warriors, I call them. They go hiking 5-10 miles through the Appalachian, or they'll go do like a Spartan race where it's a 3-mile run or a 5K run, but there's a lot of obstacles you may do. So it should be enjoyable. Find what's enjoyable to you and what's going to make you consistent, and then everything will just fall in place after that.
So now let's talk about the distinction between being just a regular athlete, someone who exercises just for good health or for fun, versus professional athletes. First and foremost, when is there a best age to start a sport if one is interested in becoming a professional athlete, or does it depend on the sport?
I mean, if your overall goal is to become a professional athlete, I think that person won't really know that maybe their career or their goal in life until like middle school or high school. But if, let's say, I mean, some parents think their kids are going to be the next Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. They may start the kids early as 2 and 3, and that's fine. Just have them play sports at an early age. The only thing I don't like that I'm starting to see in my tenure of doing this is kids start at that early age, but they only play one sport. So now what we're seeing is these kids, once they are in middle school or they are in high school, they're starting to get a lot more injuries, and they're more overuse injuries. Mm. And it's the same type of injuries that we would see professional athletes in the 90s have when they're in their mid-20s and late 30s. But now these kids are getting it at a much younger age, during a puberty age as well, where it could even affect their continual growth or development. So if you're going to start sports, hey, 2 or 3 is great, but give variety. Like when I grew up, I played 3 sports a year. I did baseball, basketball, and football. So I would try to nurture that environment, give them all these different traits, skills, or assets that they can get, the cross-training effect from playing all these different sports. And then you never know. Maybe when they're in high school, they'd be like, hey, Dad, Mom, I really like basketball. And then you can steer your focus to that. But that kid's going to be a lot more developed and ready to now take on any challenges they're going to face going forth.
And you made such a good point regarding injuries. And we'll talk more about injuries later in the program. And now, when it comes to being a professional athlete, would you say some people are predisposed to becoming professionals, perhaps physically?
Yeah, I mean, to say that someone isn't, I mean, would be a joke. I think I've seen many kids, many professional athletes, even on TV, they'd be like, oh, this is so-and-so. Mom and Dad were both Olympic track athletes, or Dad played college basketball and the mom ran track in college. You're definitely going to get some sort of genetic potential passed down. Mm-hmm. When they're born, but at the end of the day, it's up to that person to take full use of that potential that they might have been given as a child. So I think it goes hand in hand. Like the ones that are given that genetic potential, it's up to them to now train hard and get the full use of it for them to make it. And then even if your parents weren't great college athletes or great pro athletes, doesn't mean you can't be a professional athlete. If you put in the time and the work, I think everyone's capable of reaching their goals if they hold themselves accountable and, you know, try their hardest.
It's because when you look at someone like Shaquille O'Neal, I mean, really, nature has given him like 75%. I don't know. I'm just saying this to joke, but his height alone can make him a champion at basketball. But of course, it's not just about height. You know, there's techniques involved and so much more involved. But I'm just saying, you know, it seems when we talk about predisposition, maybe some people are just blessed that way. So let's talk about is training, actually. Is there such a thing as too much training? I mean, in your line of work, talk to us first about what you do, and then we'll get to training.
Yeah, so in my line of work, I'm a director now. I've been doing this for over 10 years at One Life Fitness. So I oversee trainers. I basically educate trainers so they know how to program their clients correctly and progress them to reach their goals. And at the same time, I still keep some clients myself. I mean, I feel like you always got to keep learning, you got to keep yourself involved because you got to know what's going on. So if you're not staying involved, you may fall behind a little bit. So I still train a lot of youth to professional athletes, usually 2-4 hours a day, and then I'm doing more basically growing my team and then getting them ready to take the next step in fitness if it is they're trying to get ready for competition themselves or they're trying to move up into management. Yeah, that's pretty much what I do for my living.
So when you train athletes, what would you say are the main differences between training a professional athlete versus a commoner like me, for example, who would want to exercise just to get in shape, stay in shape?
Yeah. I mean, to start off, I mean, both you versus professional athlete, you guys are going to be very, very similar. The first time I see someone, I basically want to make sure that you can do the simple things very well, okay? And then we just check you off from there. So if you can do a push-up, great. I'm going to progress you to the next movement, which may be like a dumbbell press. And if you do that, I'm going to go to a bench press. So starting off, you and a professional athlete will be the same. But then how we evolve or how we progress or improve from there may be more rapid for a professional professional athlete to the point where they may be further ahead in their strength training or their speed training or their plyometric training. And when we get into that, that's really now on me to continue to give them a harder aspect or more challenging aspect of training. That way their body has to make a change to meet those demands. And that's what sort of makes them unique. Professional athletes can learn and grasp us very, very fast and then sort of master it really fast. That's sort of the skill set that they have that separates them. And then it's on us to just continue to challenge them so they can make those adaptations to progress and go further in their training. And that way, hopefully, through those adaptations and us also helping them move better and feel better, they're going to be less prone to injury when they are doing all their games, traveling all the time. So we got to teach them also how to recover correctly. That way they don't put themselves in harm's way and can make it through the season. Because at the end of the day, when they play, they get paid. And that's a big thing when it comes to them.
Yes, indeed. Now I'm going to ask you a question that may be a bit touchy for some people, but just out of curiosity, because I'm a woman and I want to know. So when you train athletes, whether it's professional or not professional, do you make a difference between the way you approach training for a guy versus a woman?
I mean, they're both very, very similar. They're going to be almost identical, but there are some things that I will focus more on a woman versus a guy. Just anatomy-wise, your guy's hips are a little bit wider. So because of that, the female athletes, their QRS angle, so that's like your hip, your knee, and your ankle angles there, are slightly greater than men's. So that's why women are more prone to these ACL injuries that you may see. So I'll throw in some little bit more glute strengthening, quad, hamstring strengthening to be preventative in that nature towards you. And then at the same time, women, what I've noticed, do have a little bit more poor posture because of some other anatomy issues that you guys may have. So we're going to work a lot on working on your posture, your scapulars or your rear delts. That way you're standing up nice and tall and actually alleviate some of your back pain. And I'll just throw that into our normal strength training because men and women should be able to do the simple things well. Like I said, squat. Mm-hmm. You should be able to deadlift, which allows you to bend over, pick up stuff, like even your children. And then everyone should know how to do a push-up and a pull-up. So the strength standards will stay the same. But in those other areas, I'll definitely give more focus towards the women to help meet their needs in those.
And when it comes to six-packs, this is a very I mean, okay, some may say this is not a very smart question, but when it comes to six-packs, do you find that some women really want the six-packs or they just want a firm stomach and that's it? Because the six-packs, I don't know, it depends. I think it looks good on men, but for women, I'm not sure. So what is your take? What do you find in your work?
In my work, I mean, women do say, hey, they want abs. So they want more firm and tone. They don't really want, like, that bulging six-pack that you see gentlemen have all the time.
Yeah.
I think they want to feel like there's nothing going over that waistband, that there's no wrinkles or rolls there. I think they just, like, they want it to be smooth. They want it to, I don't know, be sensual. So if they can have that, that's what they're gearing towards more. But that can be hard. I mean, not all women, even if they want a six-pack, can possibly get a six-pack because you guys are great at certain things, such as you're the reason why the human race continues. You guys give birth. So there's a lot of changes that happen there.
Yes.
And you might not be able to overcome that without maybe a surgery or something. So it depends where they are in their lives and what their body may allow them to do and not to do.
That's a good point. Good to know. I thought I was the only woman who felt a bit different about six-packs women.
No.
But it's okay with men, but for women, I'm like, just give me a firm and toned stomach and that's it. All right, Riz, we really appreciate all the information you're giving us. And we are going to take a short break and come back and continue this very, very interesting discussion with Riz Gully. And in the second half of the show, we will focus on sports injuries. As you know, a lot of athletes get injured. And how can we prevent it, what to do, and more information. So we'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the show. For those of you joining us late tonight, we are discussing sports and exercise with our guest, Rhys Gully. And Rhys is giving us some very, very interesting information. Rhys is director with Brambleton One Life Fitness in Virginia. We will continue our discussion in just a few moments. But first, as we look at sports injuries in this second half of the program, VOA's David Vandy has this overview on some common sports injuries, particularly those in the knees and the ankles. Take a listen.
At some point, most athletes will suffer from an ankle sprain. This injury occurs when the person twists or rolls an ankle. The foot usually turns too quickly to the side. This damages the ligaments and tissues that support the ankle. Inside, it is the deltoid ligament that is affected, and outside, it is the lateral ones that suffer trauma. The joint takes a serious blow which causes pain when the athlete tries to move the ankle. This is often followed by swelling. That's what happened to PSG star Neymar in March 2018, following a tackle during a game. These sprains often vary according to the type of sports and the parts of the body that is most at work. Tennis players often suffer from injuries to the wrist or the shoulder. In terms of treatment, once the swelling has subsided, recovery requires a rest period and the use of a psychotherapeutic support to keep the ankle motionless. The movements are done using crutches. In some severe cases, surgery is necessary. Other types of injuries experienced by athletes include knee injuries. They are amongst the most serious in football and also the most common. They can be caused by a direct impact during a tackle or an indirect shock, such as a sudden change of direction or pace. There are several types of injuries which affect the ligaments, the meniscus, or the tendons. A torn anterior cruciate ligament is one of the most serious injuries an athlete can have. It can disable a player from 6 to 9 months, and surgery is often required.
And Rhys Gully, again, thank you for joining us. And
thank you for having me.
Now, you heard this explainer, which focused on knees and ankles injuries. First off, there is a saying in sport that injury is just part of the game. So does it mean that anyone who plays sports, any athlete, is deemed to get injured? Is it really part of the game, or is it possible to prevent injuries?
Yeah, I mean, as an athlete, I've heard people say that, but that's not something you should like look at or expect as a professional athlete or an athlete in general. Your job is to go out there and perform, and if you're asked to perform in an injured state all the time, you're not giving your full potential, and you're not giving the audience with exactly what they want. So I sort of disagree with that, because I feel if you do prepare yourself with the right training, the right recovery before and after games, and take care of your body, you can reduce the risks of actually having an injury. So, I mean, yes, some are inevitable. I think he said Neymar had an ankle sprain last year on a sliding tackle. If someone's going to hit you and there's going to be contact on contact, sometimes it's inevitable. But what we can do is try to train ourselves or have our body prepared for instances like that, where maybe we could end up preventing the injury, or maybe we could reduce the effects of what may happen with the injury. Maybe it ends up being a grade 1 sprain versus a grade 3 sprain, which means he's going to be back just after 4 weeks, maybe, instead of 3 months. So I think that's where, in the fitness industry, someone like me can be very important, because we can help reduce the risks of those. That way, that athlete can get back on the field faster and still play at a very high level. But to think that you should always be injured, I don't think that's right at all in any profession, to be honest.
So why get into it anyways if you know you're going to get injured all the time? I guess you're making a good point, because it's good to go with that reassurance that there is a way that you don't have to get injured with the proper preparation, if you will. So in the what we just heard from my colleague David Vandy, it focuses on knees and ankles injuries, and they seem to be fairly common in sports. To what extent are they more common among professional athletes versus non-professionals?
To be honest, I think they're about the same. Professional athletes, we just hear of it more because, I mean, they're in the media. But through my clients each day, they come to me, they got some ankle pain or some knee pain or that they got in their rec league or in their sport that they're playing. But I've also had clients step off a bench or someone step off a curb wrong and roll their ankle, which is a sprained ankle. So in either aspect, even if you are a professional athlete or not a professional athlete, we should be training all those aspects and those traits for that person. So let's say someone happens to trip off a curb. Are we training for them to be able to maybe catch themselves quickly so they don't roll their ankle and have a sprained ankle? So, and a lot of that training is more like reactive training or power training. So I think even as a non-professional, they should be training all those aspects. That way we can lessen the risk for both the professional athlete and the non-professional athlete and reduce all those effects. But one versus the other, I think it's about equal because athletes got contact, everyday people, they just don't move as much. So because their lack of movement, they may not be as strong or as flexible. So they're already putting themselves more at a risk. So I think it breaks out even in the end of all things.
Okay. So the RICE method to address injuries has been used over the years. And can you talk to us about what it is first, and has it been modified at some point?
Yeah, so RICE, I mean, yeah, it's been here since the dinosaurs, basically. So, and, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, I think everyone should still use it. Even when I went to college 10, 11 years ago, they were still talking about it. People still use it now. There has been a shift in if you should use it or when you should use it or how long you should use it. And I think that's changing, but still, at the end of the day, I don't think there's been enough research to make the change in the textbooks, if you know what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. So if we did look at RICE, what it is, the R stands for rest, the I stands for, obviously, ice, the C stands for compression, and the E stands for elevate. So when they say elevate, whatever limb, joint, or part of your body that you did hurt, while you're icing it and elevating it and have the compression, you should be higher than your heart. And that's going to help with the blood flow through your circulatory system and help get new blood in and out. And that way the swelling can stay reduced or even get reduced from that treatment method.
Okay. So is this something that someone will do as soon as they get injured? Meaning, like, what is the first thing someone is advised to do in a case of injury before getting to a doctor?
Yeah, so as soon as you get injured, obviously stop whatever activity you were doing. Don't try to go back to it. And then try to book that, obviously, that session with the doctor as soon as possible. But within that first 24 to 48 or 72 hours, that window, that's when you would use the RICE method. That way, when you do go to the doctor, we can have a lot of that swelling reduced. That way, they can actually see the injury a little bit better and see what may be the root cause of all that swelling, if it's more of a sprain, a tear, or a broken bone.
Okay.
And then after that 72 hours is when sort of the RICE method saying, hey, you really don't need it. Maybe you should do more heat now. But that's where that gray area starts to begin.
And you mentioned heat. I was going to ask you about that because sometimes we hear, oh, put a heating pad on an injury. Sometimes it's put ice. So when do you know what to use?
So, I mean, that comes down to the extent of the injury. So, like an ACL or something, if, like, you just had that, I would not put heat on it. I would go to the RICE method, go to a doctor. But let's say you pulled your back or you got a tight or stiff back. Mm-hmm. That's when you could probably use a heating pad because it's going to help loosen up a lot of stuff. That way you become more mobile afterwards and start moving around a little bit better. Or anyone that might have had a back injury, you wake up in the morning, you're super, super stiff. Maybe use that to help get your body flowing because anyone that has back issues, the morning, they're tight. But by the end of the day, they'll notice that their back feels better and sort of loosened up because they've been more movement and they've gotten their core temperature up and their body temperature up just from doing their daily activities. So, but at the end of the day, that's if we know that someone doesn't have a serious back injury. That's something that maybe they've already seen a doctor and that's a treatment plan they've been given already.
Okay. Now, there is something that a lot of people have, whether they are athletes or not, and it's called plantar fasciitis. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah.
So talk to us about that, because I'm curious to find out more, because it is something that is so common, right? So what is it really, and how do we address it?
Yeah, so plantar fasciitis is very common. It's basically, it's like tightness in the arch of your foot, okay? You're going to feel an excruciating pain in the bottom or the arch of your foot. So it hurts to do anything like walking or going upstairs or running or jumping, anything that's pretty much involves impact. And then the pain can differentiate depending on the degree of the person, what they can withstand or how tight that arch is. But even though you're feeling that pain in the arch of the foot, that doesn't always necessarily mean that's what's causing it. Usually plantar fasciitis is the result of overuse from running and stuff, but the result of that overuse is because your calves have gotten super tight. Mm. So now your calves are pulling up on your heel of your foot, and the heel of your foot is now pulling up on the plantar fasciitis underneath your foot there. So you feel the pain in your foot, but it's a referral pain from the calf because the calf is so tight. So ways to work around that is use the Rice method, take an anti-inflammatory.
Could it be the shoes you wear, maybe, that can cause that? Do you know?
It could be, yeah. I mean, if you're using shoes that are very, very supportive and you're never really walking around on your feet, okay, and engaging those foot muscles and those toe muscles, mm-hmm, some stuff can get shut off. It's okay. Sort of the same like someone that sits at their desk all day and their hips get tight, so their glutes shut off and they have back pain. Okay. It's almost like it's the same thing for your foot.
Okay. We're going to, the time is running out, but I have two very important questions I'd like you to touch on, please. What techniques do you advise to prevent injuries during sports?
So techniques, I would say, just have a well-balanced training program. Have a well-balanced approach. Make sure you're doing some sort of soft tissue work, mobility work, strength work, some sort of speed and agility or plyometric where you're taught how to land and run correctly, and then make sure you're also being conditioned well, because a lot of those injuries happen to athletes that are deconditioned. So if you got all that and we're focusing more on the quality of something versus how much you actually do it, that means you're moving well but not too much. I think those are all things that you can work on, especially with the ACL and the knees. We get a lot of single leg, lower body exercises. Work on your pillar, which is your glutes, core, and your scaps. Mm-hmm. And then the simple stuff, like get 8 hours of sleep a night. Make sure you're eating a balanced diet and staying hydrated. And then when you have your events, make sure you're warming up properly. But then cooling down at the end of your event, stretching, making sure you're getting yourself ready for the next day. That way, that night, you can recover to the best means possible.
And Riz, the last question. When someone has already been injured, how do you prevent repetitive trauma in the same injury, overuse injury? You touched on it earlier, but very quickly.
Yeah, so when that does happen, obviously immediately stop playing your sport and then go see a doctor. And then from there, you'll have a rehab protocol. Like either they'll do some rehab on that joint or that injury that you have, or at the same time, if you hurt your ankle, some other issues that could arise could be knee and hip stuff. So don't just deal with the injury when you have your rehab. Work on that, obviously, but also work on anything that may be in that kinetic chain that's attached to that injury that might have gotten disrupted because the body's sort of going into a safeguard motion when you do get injured.
Okay, Riz, and how can people find out more about your work and where you are?
Yeah, so I mean, everyone does social media today. I mean, for Twitter and Instagram, I got Trainer Gully.
Okay, Trainer Gully, and that's Gully.
That is correct.
Riz Gully, yes.
And from there, you can, my website and my email, all my contacts there. So I'm always open. I'm more than happy to help anyone, so shoot me an email.
Great, Riz Gully. Thank you so much for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
And we thank our guest, Riz Gully. He's site director with Brimbleton One Life Fitness. For more on today's show, keep the conversation going on facebook.com/healthchatvoa. I'm your host, Lenore Mundo, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown and Nashua, our engineer. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News.